Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. The thread question of the week is coming up later. Now we're in depth on the identity crisis confronting Democrats.
We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America, and I always will. And if you do, then we must accept this result and then look to the future.
The Clinton era is over. President Obama is soon going back to private life, and Republicans are running the show in Washington and in many state capitals. Don't miss the impact of that. Republican strongholds in state legislatures. So what does it mean today to be a Democrat? One of today's guests, Michael Kazin, told Politico magazine months before Clinton lost, having Trump there makes Democrats think they haven't really got a problem, which I think they still do have a problem. And Mr. Kazin was right. As our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you. Are you a DFLer? What does being a Democrat mean today? And for everyone, what do Democrats have to prioritize as they rebuild from the rubble of this election? So I'd love to hear from you this morning. If you're a DFLer, if you're a Democrat in the region, what do Democrats mean? What does it mean to be a Democrat today? What do Democrats have to prioritize as they rebuild from the results of this election? Who's on the bench? Who's rising as a Democratic leader? 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter. I've tweeted out a question on this. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Elaine Kmark is with us, senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, and she's with us today from Washington. Elaine, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
Michael Kazin is with us. He's professor of history at Georgetown and editor of Dissent magazine, and he's with us from Washington. Michael, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Last summer, as part of that Politico roundtable, you said Democrats still have a problem. And here's how you diagnose the problem. They have intellectual, upper middle class, well-educated people, and they have black people and Latinos. And the broad middle is still up for grabs. Democrats have not found a way to win those people over in any kind of convincing way. Was it those broad middle voters you spoke about that delivered what Hillary Clinton found to be a pretty shocking result on election night?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was such a good prophet.
But you were.
Look, I mean, obviously, as we know, the election was very close. Hillary Clinton won perhaps 2 million more votes than Donald Trump did when all the votes will be counted. But Democrats, in becoming a very diverse party, a very cosmopolitan party, racially and otherwise, have neglected, I think, both in policy and in rhetoric in many ways, the white lower middle class, white working class, people who don't live in big cities. We know this is true, but Hillary Clinton did a very poor job of appealing to these people, I think. She thought she could only sort of run against Donald Trump because he had so many flaws, personally and otherwise, but clearly that wasn't quite enough. But in the long run, you know, I think the people we're talking about, especially white working people, whether in the Iron Range up there or other places, they used to have strong unions. They don't have them anymore for the most part, though some do. And so, you know, there's sort of they don't have institutions like some other groups in the Democratic Coalition do, which help to give people a sense that of how to learn about politics, of how to organize politically. And so I think that's a problem. Working people, white working people, need institutions. If they're not going to have unions, they need something else. And Democrats usually appeal to them and mobilize them through institutions, not just directly.
Got it. So, Elaine, here's part of the puzzling problem here, because we hear so much about the demographic change that's mm-hmm. happening in the country. So can Democrats be forgiven for believing that on the cusp of or maybe perhaps entering into this demographic change, they didn't need those white working class voters as much as they turned out to need them, that they didn't believe that they needed them because they could activate the Obama coalition, which shows that he didn't need them as much because he had so many voters of color turning out.
Well, I think that to a certain extent, Democrats can be forgiven for this. But what they can't be forgiven for is their failure to mobilize the Obama coalition and to recognize just the extent of the anger and frustration that there was in the middle of the country. And so Hillary underperformed in key aspects of the Obama coalition, and I think to the surprise of many, including the pollsters, Trump overperformed in rural America and places where the vote was expected to be much lower. You know, people have been telling me ever since Election Day, Hillary hit most of her targets in key states like Pennsylvania. She hit the targets, but what they didn't see coming was this wave of anger and frustration and the fact that people dismissed Trump's personal failings because his message was so powerful.
So, Elaine, given what you've just said there, was Donald Trump right that he activated people that often sit out presidential elections? So that's part of what caught Democrats by surprise. And Democrats had no message for those people that often sit out these elections.
Well, it's a little unclear. Because, in fact, voter turnout was lower all the way across the board than it had been in 2008 or even 2012. So there were fewer people voting. So I'm not quite sure how many were brand new. We'll have to sort of sift through that. What is clear is that people who were really on the fence until the last week or so moved towards Trump. And I think that that explains why everybody thought Hillary was going to win. And then at the end, there was a lot of movement towards Trump, high turnout in those areas, et cetera. And obviously, the Comey letter from the FBI director had to do with this. But I also think that, and I watched this with some surprise, in the last 2 weeks, 10 days of the campaign, Trump put away his Twitter account, which was useful, and he should put that away permanently. And he started focusing on more traditional Republican attack lines, like the rising premium costs in Obamacare.
Right.
And those were issues that had stood the Republicans well in 2010 and 2014. And when he came back to those, I think it, instead of sort of, you know, the Miss Universe and all the sort of silly stuff, when he came back to those, I think he probably helped move some last-minute voters.
Michael, a call for you from Alexander in Rochester. Hey, Alexander, what are you thinking about here?
Well, the lady's right. The Clintons took away jobs. Obama didn't bring anything back. Why would you vote for a Democrat? And then at the same time, the independent candidate, Bernie Sanders and Dr. Jill Stein, they gave us, you know, pocketbook policies of a single-payer health plan and voting against the TPP as well as Trump. So why would I, a Democrat, vote for a person that's not going to do anything for small businesses, for working people? And my children, and I've got four of them, and they're married, none of them voted for, especially the women, were adamant that she's dishonest and she's going to say whatever she wants to say to get elected. And my daughter said, who would vote for that?
Okay, so there's a lot there. I do want to note that Bernie Sanders was not the independent candidate. He ran as a Democrat in the primary, and Hillary Clinton beat him to be the Democratic nominee. Michael, to some of those pocketbook issues that I think you talked about that the broad middle of voters want to hear about, Alexander says he wasn't hearing about them.
And look, I've heard this from a lot of people. I know people who said, well, I voted for Bernie Sanders, but I can't vote for Hillary, but you know, maybe I'll vote for Trump. You know, there's the Democrats, especially Hillary Clinton's campaign, should have seen the fact that Bernie Sanders came out of nowhere, really nowhere, independent candidate, most people outside Vermont never heard his name, to get 10, 11 million votes. You know, he lost the primaries fair and square, I think, to Hillary, despite what some of his supporters thought and maybe still think. But this should have been a danger signal for Hillary that, you know, maybe, you know, he was tapping something. He had much more enthusiastic backers, I think, on the ground, certainly among young people, certainly, than Hillary did. And part of the problem, too, of course, is that Hillary was a known quantity. She'd been there so long. She was shackled with some of the policies in the 1990s, which were seen as, you know, too conservative.
Are you talking about trade and criminal justice or what specifically?
Justice, I mean, whatever happened in the 90s, she was blamed for unfairly in some cases. But that's not the point. And, you know, part of the problem, too, is that and Americans, I think I was tell my students and others, you know, it doesn't matter if you like the president or not. You elect a Democrat, you're electing a whole bunch of social forces and giving the president the right to appoint all these people and justices of the courts and so forth. But Americans want to like their president. And Hillary, in that sense, you know, didn't give people much. She didn't give people any hope. And if you have a candidate who, in effect, is the incumbent, as she, in effect, was, who doesn't give people any hope, and your opponent plays to people's fears quite effectively, as Trump did, you've got a problem.
James says on Twitter, adopting and embracing a progressive agenda. Keith Ellison seems to be getting a lot of attention nationally. Of course, a congressman from Minnesota who's put his hat in the ring for the DNC chair. Joe says, perhaps when you poll everyday folks, progressive programs are popular. We have a messaging and a turnout problem. Michael, is that true? That people will respond favorably to a progressive agenda, but Democrats don't know how to turn them out?
Well, we'll have to see. As Elaine knows very well, you know, she has a lot of experience setting Democratic agendas and from the 90s till now, maybe before then, too. You know, on the one hand, what Bernie said was very popular, I think, among a lot of people. But, of course, also, he didn't get attacked by Republicans. I mean, after all, he wanted to raise pretty much everyone's taxes to pay for single payer health care, which a lot of people, most people already have health insurance, which they like well enough. So that would have been a problem. So, you know, I'm a progressive Democrat. I'm a left-wing Democrat. I certainly wish the party was, you know, followed the kind of things Bernie Sanders was talking about more. But one can't say that, if Hillary only ran on Bernie Sanders' program, everything would have been fine. I'm not sure that's true. A lot of people don't trust government, and that's a problem for Democrats more than Republicans.
Elaine, Joe's saying here that the progressive agenda is popular. It's that Democrats couldn't turn out the people that would have supported them. Is that true?
Well, the problem with that is that the Democrats did turn out the people they thought they were going to turn out, with a couple of exceptions. They took for granted the women's vote. And in the end, the gender gap was just not nearly as big as it was in previous elections. And then they underperformed in majority black congressional districts, and they underperformed among Latinos. And I think that this was surprising to the Hillary campaign. It certainly was surprising to a lot of Democrats, given how hostile Trump himself was during various parts of the campaign. And what I think it spoke to is the fact that Trump campaign did a very good job of turning Hillary into some kind of criminal, which, you know, is not the case. In fact, in today's paper, Trump is saying, no, he's not going to pursue criminal charges against Hillary, because, frankly, that was always ridiculous. But he did a good job of convincing people that, ready to be convinced, that there was something really wrong and distrustful about her. She didn't break any laws. She's not going to be prosecuted. She was never going to be prosecuted. But they managed to demonize her in a way that I think held back pieces of her base.
But Elaine, he was pretty effective in what I was going to say, in demonizing himself, but he denied. I mean, I'm thinking about all of the evidence that build up that would call his character into question.
Absolutely.
But for him, it didn't seem to matter.
Well, because he was the change candidate. And I think that the most powerful dynamic in this election was that people were sick of the Democrats, I think Michael said it early in the program that Barack Obama, for all of his popularity, did not deliver to a lot of people in this country. He didn't deliver jobs. People have jobs, according to the numbers, but they're not the jobs that they had or that they think they should have. And so given that there was a sort of, okay, we tried this crowd, and given that the Trump campaign managed to try to make Hillary as questionable in character as Trump was, that, you know, if you have two slimy people, right, they cancel each other out, and then people go to what's the next issue. Well, then the big issue in this election was from the beginning change and a desire for change. It always is after two terms with one party in power. You know, it's a really hard, that's always an uphill battle. And so if you cancel each other out on a trustworthiness, which I think these two candidates did, for rightly or wrongly, right? If you cancel each other out, then you go to the next, you know, important issue, and that really was change. And I think that was, in the end, Trump's advantage, even though it was a not a popular vote win. And many of these states, Hillary lost by very small numbers.
Elaine Kmark with us, if you've just tuned in, from Brookings, and Michael Kazin with us from Georgetown, as we consider how Democrats pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and rebuild from the election. New leadership, new ideas, new ways of turning out and appealing to voters that did not support Democrats in this presidential election. 651-227-6000, as you consider, are you a DFLer? What does being a Democrat mean today? And for everyone, everyone in the region, DFLer, of course, how we identify as Democrats in Minnesota. But for everyone listening in our region here, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, Iowa, I'd like to hear what you think Democrats have to prioritize as they rebuild from the election. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @KerryMPR. Where Mark says, for 40 years under Democrats, president, we've added jobs at three times the rate of Republican presidents and wages grow faster. Don't voters care? Another listener here says, why a choice between two old white people? No 60-plus Democratic president since Truman. Need younger and more diverse. And to the phones to Jill in Woodbury. Hi, Jill. Thanks so much for waiting. By the way, I'm just going to say that, Jill, you have to turn your radio down, and if you're getting a busy signal on the phone lines, please call us back, because I know a lot of you want to get in on this. Hi, Jill, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
This is Hunter calling. Yes. Actually, what I want to make a comment about is that the DFL has really forgotten the word farmer in the Democratic Farmers and Laborers part. So what happens is that if you look around, like most of the farms, and mostly in Minnesota there's a lot of farms, a lot of Trump Pence signs. And what I think we have to do as Democrats is that we have to reach out back to the farmers. But the reason why the farmers changed to Republicans is because of the simple fact that, you know, they started making over $100,000 because of all the subsidies through the corn and soybean subsidies that are provided through the government. So what happens is that they're in a totally different tax bracket now. So then what we have to do is reach out to the farmers to bring them back to the DFL party.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. To Joe, listening in Rochester. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, how you doing?
Hi. Tell me what you're thinking about as you listen to the conversation.
Well, I think you're hitting it on the head on a lot of it. The biggest thing that I've ran into is all my friends and stuff like that that I know that were going towards Trump. They kept on saying that Hillary's a liar. And I kept on asking them, I said, well, what has she lied about? I said, you know, I said, give me some examples or give me some idea, you know what I mean? And they never could come up with a direct lie. But I says, you look at the Trump, he'll actually contradict himself on the TV right there on some of his lies. And he'll basically call her a nasty woman, even though he respects women. It it doesn't match what was going on. And I go to all these, DFL meetings on that one, and I've actually been to the Republican meetings too, because I go to both of them.
And Joe, your essential point here is
that what I'm getting at is that the Democrats seem to fight between each other on principles on certain things, but the Republicans, when I go to their meetings to listen in to what's going on, they tend not to end fight, and they don't question very much what's going on. They go in a certain direction as a group.
Joe, let me take this to Michael Kazin. I mean, all we heard about was the civil war within the Republican Party. Didn't seem to matter.
No, because in the end, Republicans do come together. And my son, who's an operative for the Democratic Party, says Republicans don't need as good a turn-in operation because Republicans vote more reliably than Democrats do. And also, I think one of the things that the conservative takeover of the Republican Party meant is that the most avid conservatives are very strong Republicans. The most avid liberals, people on the left of American politics, often are very ambiguous about the Democratic Party. You know, I knew a lot of people, young people, some who worked for my magazine, Dissent Magazine, who said, well, you know, of course we're going to vote for Hillary, but, you know, I don't really care whether she wins or not. I mean, there was a sense of, another Clinton, oh, my God, do we really want that? Whereas I think in the end, as we saw, even Republicans who said they would never support Trump, who said he was the worst thing ever, most of them did come back and support him. It was really more certain Republican leaders who were unhappy about what he was saying. But the rank and file Republicans pretty much turned out because they care about abortion. They care about the Supreme Court. They are, I hate to say this as a Democrat, but Republicans are sometimes actually more sort of realistic about the stakes in a presidential election than.
Well, that's interesting. Elaine, do you think that's true?
Yeah, Michael's hitting the nail on the head there. I mean, when I looked at the exit poll results the day after the election day, my first impression was, oh, all the Republicans came home. The Republicans just came home in spite of their leaders being very divided over Trump, in spite of all the questions about Trump's character, his business dealings, his temperament. Basically, Republican voters came home. He had big evangelical votes, big votes among the evangelicals, big votes among religious people. And the Democrats did not to the extent that the Republicans did. And I think that story was the story of the election.
You know, Elaine, what you said about the evangelicals is really interesting because we did a show, I don't know, it's probably 2 months ago, with a guest who was writing about how for evangelical voters, this has become really about politics and not about faith. Does the evangelical support for Donald Trump really verify that?
Oh, it sure does. I mean, of all the people that is not someone that you would think a deeply religious person would look up to and admire, Donald Trump's got to be at the top of the list with his attitude towards women, his admitted history of adultery, his three wives. You know, I mean, the sort of absence of any real charitable giving. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And yet, to my surprise, and I think to the surprise of many, if I'm remembering the exit polls correctly, he got 81% of the evangelical vote. That is quite healthy. And I think that that reflected a deep commitment to the Republican Party. Maybe some of those people held their nose and voted for Trump. But they voted for Trump.
Catherine says on Twitter, if Democrats have to fight voter suppression, fake news, misogyny, racism, etc., it's hard to win. We need young, less cynical energy. Steph off the page.
James says the myth that communities of color don't turn out to vote is false. The DFL has a problem turning out communities of color because they take them for granted.
Michael, I want to take that to you. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm a white person, so perhaps, I'm not the best person to testify to that. But, I think Democrats have policies which, at least on the page, do not take people of color for granted. I mean, certainly the Justice Department under both the African-American Attorney General, the last two, has taken important steps, I think, to get police departments to clean up their act in terms of racial profiling, in terms of, committing violence against African-Americans. And so I think that's an important step forward. I think programs like Obamacare, much has been derided, did extend health care to a lot of people of color, and if a lot of states run by Republicans had accepted the Medicaid extension, a lot more people of color would be getting health care than are getting it now. I think the problem is that Democrats are, as I said before, a very broad party demographically, and President Obama, understandably, even though he was the first black president, made it pretty clear early in his administration that he couldn't be, you know, a politician primarily for African Americans or for any other particular group. He had to be president for all the people.
Mm-hmm.
That meant frustrating some people who expected him as the first black president to be a president more for black people and perhaps other racial minorities as well. So, you know, I think I understand the frustration. We expect politicians to do a lot. And we expect especially the party of government, which the Democrats sort of traditionally have been since the 1930s, to do more for people who are suffering, people in trouble. And I think they try, not perhaps hard enough, but there's a problem when, of course, you've got a lot of pushback from people who are not of color saying, what about us? You know, and of course, part of the people who voted for Obama a couple times and this year voted for Trump is they probably said, well, you know, it's enough. No one's talking about my problems. And I'm going to vote for somebody who seems like to talk about my problems. So you can't win. You can't get a majority of the electorate on your side. You can't form a enduring majority as the Democrats once had if you only talk about the problems of part of the population.
Call here from Jane in St. Paul. Hi, good morning, Jane.
Hi, good morning. You know, I happen to be an African-American, and I will try to speak to the fact that African-Americans did vote. If we look at the polls, but the statistics, 94% of African-American women voted for Hillary. 96% of African-American women in 2012 voted for President Obama. 88% of African-American men voted for Hillary. 53% of white women voted for Trump. And I wonder why it is we always skirt around the fact that there was a racial element that was very deep with some people. Anytime you get to the point where you're saying 1 week before the election, I'm just not sure. And I concentrated on working with millennials, and I'm a long way from being a millennial, but I talked to so many millennials, African-American and white millennials, and they would ask questions, and they would say things like, well, she's never done anything for anyone. Well, I think it's interesting that when I would point out various things that she had done, they seemed to be new. What Trump did that was very effective, I think, is that he not only did he demonize her, but because he, and I happen to be married to someone who is a psychiatrist, fits the bill for some people of being in an area that is really questionable mentally. I would only say this with his narcissism, and it is so strong. He really was effective in making people see her as someone they could not trust.
Yeah,
and then the other element that's underlying, and I've seen it with my friends and even myself, who happens to be a light-colored African-American who sometimes wears a scarf around her head. I was about a month ago, I was at a Cub food store, and a man called me, "You dirty Arab, you can't drive," because my car had gone up a curb when I was making a U-turn. And I looked at him and I said, "Sir, my ancestors were slaves hoping to build this country when yours were still trying to learn how to read to find a book to come over on." And then I walked on into the store and I said it in a low tone.
Jane, I would not tangle with you. I think that's
one of my dearest friends, in fact, my best friend, who happens also to be white, said to me, said it to the wrong one, didn't he? Goodbye, girls. I just want you to know, I don't think we took her. That we were taken for granted.
Okay.
That we knew that it was also Obama's wish that we go for the Democrat, because he really wasn't effective in the ways that he might have been.
Elaine, will you respond? Jane, thank you, as always. Elaine, will you respond to what Jane is alluding to, which is there's been some blame towards communities of color saying, well, if you turn out in larger numbers the way you supported Obama, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Well, I mean, not entirely right, but there was a drop-off in the total black vote. They did support They did support Hillary. They did support Obama in 2012, but not quite as much. And I think Jane has hit on something that I was talking about earlier. Look, the Trump campaign managed to paint a caricature of Hillary Clinton as someone who was deeply dishonest and was an establishment person and didn't care about people. You know, she started her life as in the Children's Defense Fund, which is one of the most, you know, deeply liberal and compassionate organizations ever, looking out for the rights of children who are in real trouble, and headed by a woman named Marion Wright Edelman, who is a black woman who is, you know, an incredibly powerful figure in American life. So, I mean, they're just all this weird stuff that happened to Hillary. And again, I think that I saw this happen in 2004 with John Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that the Republicans managed to turn John Kerry, a real war hero, they went right at the war hero status and managed to turn John Kerry, make it questionable about whether he'd won his medal.
But Elaine, and Michael, come in on this. I have to say, I think, yes, I remember the 2004 race with John Kerry and George W. Bush and all of that. But I have to say, I think Hillary Clinton said some very specific and hard-charging things about Donald Trump. I don't know that the Democrats had to take it any more than they dished it out.
Yeah, if I could comment, I mean, yeah. we're doing, in some ways, replaying, you know.
I know. And the show is supposed to be like how do Democrats rebuild? But you have to understand where you came from, don't you, in some ways?
If you're defending yourself against charges, you're a liar. If you're defending yourself against charges that you haven't done anything for people, and you're not able to turn that in a positive direction, then you've got a political problem. I mean, you have to take for granted that the other side, especially when against someone like Donald Trump, who, of course, had no particular ethics about what he was going to say, about the truth of it or not, you know, then you've got to have a strategy to deal with that. And for all kinds of reasons, we can replay this again if we want to. But Hillary did not have an effective way of doing that. And to sort of, you can explain, you know, why she was unfairly attacked and everything else. But unfair attacks are part of politics. And John Kerry didn't understand how to turn that around, and Hillary didn't either. And of course, this has been true, you know, beyond that for Democrats in midterm elections, as we know, which is the real failure of Barack Obama's administration. I'm very supportive of a lot of what the president has done, was not to really build the party in, you know, middle America.
Yeah.
Geographically.
Yeah, and, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly.
And that, you know, he was, his personal popularity was great. He was able to win election for himself, but except in 2008, he did not bring Congress along with him.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up because, as I noted at the beginning of the conversation, Republicans not only won the White House and made gains in Congress and won the majorities, they made some major gains in state capital. So I want to talk about, with Elaine and Michael, the implications of that as well. And as you listen in to how this conversation is moving and changing, I hope you're still thinking about, what do Democrats have to prioritize? We've done a lot of, here's what she did wrong, here's what happened. Part of the show really has to be to look ahead. So I want to hear from you about how Democrats prioritize. What is it they should be talking about? Who are the leaders that perhaps they should be turning to as they rebuild from the rubble? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Kerry NPR. Back on the other side of news in a minute. But to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Kerry. As your guest mentioned, a top advisor to Donald Trump is the says the president-elect will not pursue a probe of Hillary Clinton's private email. Kellyanne Conway told MSNBC Trump is setting a tone for congressional Republicans by refraining from calling for more investigations. She says he does not wish to pursue these charges. Trump, during the campaign, said he'd like to see his Democratic rival in jail. Donald Trump may be visiting with the New York Times after all today. Spokesman Hope Hicks told reporters gathered in Trump Tower this morning Trump was going to the New York Times later in the day. The statement comes only hours after Trump tweeted he would not be meeting with the newspaper. He wrote on Twitter he canceled the meeting because the terms and conditions had been changed. A school official says six students are in intensive care and six others still hospitalized after a school bus crash in Chattanooga, Tennessee, killing five children. Chattanooga Mayor Andy Burke says the city is in mourning. The bus driver was arrested and has been charged with five counts of vehicular homicide, along with reckless driving and reckless endangerment. New analysis finds the Islamic State group has used chemical weapons at least 52 times since 2014 in Iraq and Syria, including 19 times in the Mosul area alone. It says there's a high risk the group will deploy the weapons again in Mosul against civilians or the military forces trying to retake that northern Iraqi city. And stocks are rising further into record territory today in early trading. A day after rising energy prices lifted equities to new heights, the Dow reached the 19,000 mark for the first time this morning. Strong quarterly earnings from a raft of food and retail companies also boosted stocks. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:42.
Can't listen to the whole in-depth conversation? You know where to find these discussions on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. By the way, a lot of you still listening to the Friday Roundtable, where we debate how and why to break up with a book. It was a lot of fun, got a little heated. You can listen to it and find it on iTunes.
Programming is supported by the McKnight Foundation, driving sustainable solutions to help the Midwest be a leader in advancing a clean energy economy. Online at McKnight.org.
Coming up at the top of the 10 o'clock news, I don't know if you're watching your Twitter feed here, but there's a lot of action around Donald Trump's willingness to meet with the New York Times. Will he or won't he? Looks like the meeting is back on for 12:30 Eastern time. And so Jim Rutenberg from The Times is going to join us. He is commenting also on this idea of fake news. But, of course, I'm going to talk to him about what's going on with The Times. Back to the conversation now. Elaine Kmark with us from Brookings and Michael Kazin with us from Georgetown. Elaine, let's spend just a minute here and talk about what this means that Republicans were so dominant in state capitals, in governor's offices and in majorities in state legislatures. What does that say to you?
Well, it says it portends trouble for the Democrats ahead because, first of all, that means that they don't have much of a deep bench. And in politics, like in sports, you want to have a deep bench because you want new and young people coming up. I think many of our callers have referred to the fact that we had two pretty old candidates this time. And I think you want new young people coming up and able to move up through the ranks and eventually run for president. So that's number one. Uh-huh. Number two is that as we move into 2018 and then 2020, we will redistrict again. And, of course, the power of drawing those lines lies with state legislatures. So the more that are controlled by Republicans, the more it means that Republicans will try once again to draw districts that are favorable to them. The Republicans in the House control the House and probably will for quite some time, and yet Democrats get huge votes overall for the House of Representatives. And what that tells you is that the way the districts are drawn favors the Republican Party. And the Democrats aren't going to be able to erase that if the Republicans still control legislatures around the 2020 redistricting.
And Michael, we should say, because these redistricting procedures are political, and the party in power, even though, as in with Minnesota and our region and others, it often goes to court, the party in power often gets to put their stamp on it. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. That's how the system works. That's how it's set up by the Constitution and by precedent ever since then. There's another problem, too, which I'm sure your listeners are aware of, which is that really core Democratic constituencies tend to live in big cities and right around big cities and in college towns. And, you know, if you look at the counties which voted Republican this time, the counties voted Democratic, far more counties voted Republican. The counties that voted Democratic have more people in them in most cases around big cities. And there, Democrats win state legislative seats, congressional seats by huge margins. But, of course, that's not enough, given the way the electoral system works. So, you know, I think I wish, you know, more Democratic activists would move out of Twin Cities and move to, you know, Thief River Falls, Bemidji.
Why don't you come move to Thief River Falls if you're so? It's a beautiful place, Michael.
I've been to seminars in those places. And, you know, they're pleasant places. But, you know, I know people like my children and others, you know, who grew up in the Washington area, you know, go to college, you know, they want to live around people like themselves.
Yeah.
Fine, you want to have a pleasant life. But if you want to change the politics of the country, you got to spread out.
Lynn Marie says, must fight gerrymandering, allowing GOP to gain keep state seats. And number two, voter suppression. Can't go forward without fixing either. And then Joan says, growing up in my union family, I felt the positive impact of the DFL in daily life. Dems need to refocus on day-to-day issues year-round. And step off the page.
Rick says, the bench? How about Amy Klobuchar, Tom Perez, Martin O'Malley, Elizabeth Warren, Deval Patrick, Sherrod Brown, or Julian Castro? All this talk about a shallow bench is just wrong. The future is ours.
Elaine, is it wrong?
Well, I think that's a great list of names, and it's a very optimistic, But the fact is, we don't have a lot of governors. We have some senators, but we don't have as many. And we don't have the sheer numbers of elected officials at the state legislative level coming up through the ranks as the Republicans do. So there we do have that is optimistic. We do have some good people out there, but we just don't have as many as they do. And, you know, life is very random. So things happen to people and they don't make it to the top. And we need a bigger bench. That's all there is to it.
Okay, back to the phone. So many people. I don't want to ignore everybody that wants to get in on this. To Caleb near Elk River. Hi, Caleb. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure. What are you thinking about?
Well, as a millennial gay man living in rural Minnesota,
so glad you called.
I felt like I didn't really fit into any of the demographic categories that everything kind of played out in.
Right.
We had an unprecedented election with two extremely unlike candidates, and that really played out in the voter turnout levels. But also, I think the Democrats kind of buried their head in the sands when Bernie Sanders started raising in the ranks way more than anyone predicted. And they thought that because Hillary beat him, whether fairly or not or whatever, not going into that, that they didn't have a problem with that populist movement and that anti-corruption movement that seems to be sweeping the nation as a whole. And in fact, the states, the swing states that weren't supposed to be swing states that Trump ended up winning, were the same ones that Bernie Sanders won in landslides in the primary. I was thinking they needed to adopt a more populist, a more anti-corruption platform in the future to kind of reach out to those voters to make them feel like they can be franchised. They don't have to be unhappy with their government.
So, Michael, two things about Caleb. He's exactly the kind of voter that you were speaking to when you said, I know you love to live in cities, but you have to move outside of the cities. And then what he's saying about a more populist message.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I've written a lot about populism in the past. I mean, I think, as I said before, I think even though Bernie Sanders, you know, might not have been able to win a general election if he'd been the nominee, a lot of things he was talking about were clearly very popular, and not just among Democrats, among a lot of, you know, working class Republicans too, who are not, you know, who are not necessarily excited by Trump, but thought he was better than Hillary. You know, this is, you know, these choices, presidential elections do come down to a binary. You know, do you like this person better than the other person? Are you a strong Democrat or a strong Republican? You know, despite the fact that we've come back from the Great Recession, there's still a lot of cynicism and hangover from the recession. It was quite a shock what happened. And I think Americans were very uneasy, even those who voted for one party or the other. Most of them were not at all sure that their party had the answers. And, you know, I think as Elaine was saying before, Hillary, even if she'd been a better candidate, I don't think she was a very good one, but if she'd been a better candidate, was going to be seen as another 4 years for Barack Obama, another 4 years for Barack Obama's plans. And even though Obama himself was popular, a lot of his programs were either not popular or people were sort of split whether they were good or not. And that was a problem.
Michael, let me ask you this. If Hillary Clinton had won, would you still be saying to Politico magazine and other publications that the Democrats needed to do some serious identity searching?
Yes.
Really need to be? You would?
Yes, because, first of all, if she won, as you know, she would have won very narrowly.
Yeah.
And with a minority of the popular vote, though she would have gotten, of course, more popular votes than Trump did. And also what Elaine was talking about. I mean, you still, Democrats used to win places like Arkansas and West Virginia. And now nobody even thinks about Democrats winning those states anymore in presidential elections, or for that matter, winning most times for the Congress in most of those districts, unless they're heavily black districts. Democrats want to be a national party, the kind of party they were in the 30s and the 1960s and 1990s to a degree as well under Bill Clinton. You know, they have to change some things or else they're going to be able to win presidential elections from time to time, but they're not going to be able to take over Congress. And then you can't really change the country.
You know, Elaine, what's so weird about this is reverse the parties, fill in the GOP mm-hmm. party. And we were having this exact same conversation 2 weeks before the election. But
yes.
We were talking about how Republicans were, because, again, of the way the demographics of America are changing, we're going to look at years and years of presidential elections that they couldn't win.
That's right. Well, and that frankly is still the case.
Okay, that's what I wondered.
The demographics, the long-term demographics are still very much against the Republican Party at the presidential level. This year, however, and in fact, the white vote this year dropped from 72% in 2012 to 70% this time.
Uh-huh.
So that's an indication of, you know, and that will continue to drop as we go forward. But the trust issue really hurt. While we've been talking, I looked up on my computer the exit polls. On the question from this year, is Hillary Clinton honest and trustworthy? 61% say no. Is Donald Trump honest and trustworthy? 63% say no. So in other words, what you had is two, the voters looked at both of them and said, well, neither one of you are honest and trustworthy.
Right.
And so they then moved to what I think was the top of their agenda, which is they wanted something different, some change. And Hillary Clinton was a Democrat like Barack Obama. She wrapped herself in Barack Obama's mantle. And the voters said, okay, well, let's try something else. And that often happens in presidential elections. It is very rare, in fact, that a party wins a third term. The last time it happened in our lifetimes was when the first George Bush won what was essentially Ronald Reagan's third term. But it is very rare because the voters, in fact, you know, build up a store of grievances against the incumbent party, and they move to look at the other party.
Elaine, really grateful to have your insight and your analysis today. Thank you very much. I know you're busy. We appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Call here from Peter in Burnsville for Michael. Hi, Peter. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't know if I'm oversimplifying things here, but for the Dems to rebuild, I think they're going to have to go back to their roots, meaning where the working class people actually saw them as their party. I think probably you're analyzing it a lot more from a micro perspective than a macro. And the reason I say this is that Bill Clinton ran on Democratic themes to gain re-election back in the 90s. He literally ran on strong on crime, cutting back on welfare,
mm-hmm.
and he won re-election.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the Democratic Party tacked to the right, well, because they were forced to. When Barack Obama ran, the Republicans painted him as a socialist and a communist, but he won, and he won twice.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is Trump, who I call a far Republican, won on democratic values. So he literally came in and used democratic issues and themes to win the White House.
Peter, I want to ask Michael Kazin if that's true. Do you follow that analysis? Michael, do you think that's true?
I would agree, yeah. I mean, after all, economic inequality has been a Democratic issue since Franklin D. Roosevelt ran on it in the 1930s. And it's an issue that the Occupy movement raised, that labor unions have been talking about for many years. And it's an issue that, in many ways, I think it's true, Donald Trump did talk about, you know, factories and foreign trade deals that didn't help Americans. So to a degree, I think what the caller is saying is correct. On the other hand, of course, he also ran on fear of Muslims, fear of immigrants, which are not Democratic issues. So he mixed together, you might say, different kinds of populisms of the right and the left.
Michael, do you think there's a danger that the Democrats will see Trump as an anomaly and not make the kind of, as Peter suggested, kind of roots level changes that need to be made, or just, you know, really taking a hard look at what needs to be done?
There's a problem, but conversations like this, which are going on, you know, inside the Beltway, where right. Lane and I both are, I hope will end up with a healthier perspective.
So I didn't quite hear the answer to that, though.
I'm sorry. I think can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's a problem. I think that people can concentrate too much on this voter group and that voter group and who didn't turn out, who did turn out. But in a larger perspective, what President Obama did in 2008 was to excite a lot of people about what he wanted to do for America that a lot of people agreed with.
Right.
And that's what Democrats have to keep doing. They can't just say, oh, demographics will help us, because demographics only work for you if you give people a reason to vote for you. And this time, demographics were working for the Democrats, but not enough of the people who were in those rising demographic groups actually turned out to vote. And that could be a problem going forward as well.
Michael, really appreciate the chance to ask you about some of those things you said in that Politico roundtable. Thank you. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown and the editor of Dissent magazine.